Now, a radio program for people who want to live and eat healthy. Icicle presents Beyond Organic with Jerry Kay.
Thank you very much and a warm welcome to you. I've got two words for you we're going to be talking about today, two specific words. If you follow any news and take even a slight interest in the environment or care at all about the future of our food, farming, water, and air quality, you've heard these two words. You know what they are? Global warming. A quick keyword search or web news alert brings up a flood of information now more than ever. In the last 2 weeks, talk of global warming has come from some of the least likely sources. Evangelical Christians are calling for greenhouse gas reductions. Prime Minister Tony Blair of Britain says, "We have 7 years to curb emissions or it will be too late." And President Bush is calling the country addicted to oil and even mentioning alternative energy in his speeches. Well, maybe you're still wondering, how serious is the problem really? How much time do we have before our planet turns into an unlivable greenhouse? What effects are scientists seeing now? And what are possible solutions? We've got some great guests to help us find answers to these questions. Award-winning author and environmentalist Bill McKibben. He'll be joining us. His book entitled The End of Nature was the first to make global warming a mainstream topic. And a little later, John Bailey of the Institute for Local Self-Reliance will tell us how local communities, state and counties, can reduce greenhouse gases. But first, joining me from the Champlain Valley in Vermont is Bill McKibben. Bill, thank you very much for being on Beyond Organic.
My pleasure, Jerry. Good to be with you.
Last time I saw you, I think it was in Washington, D.C. at a AAAS conference or something of that sort many years ago, actually 20 or so years ago in Washington, D.C. First of all, if you would, give us your perspective on some recent global warming news. Bill, Tony Blair, for example, what do you think about his statements?
Well, I mean, Tony Blair and George Bush and everyone else are channeling the science that's coming out. You know, I mean, I've been looking at global warming, working on it for 20 years. And we've gone through all the stages. It was a hypothesis. Then we, you know, people who studied the science became convinced by about 1995 that it was for real. The planet has been warming steadily. We've begun to sense what that reality looks like in terms of melting ice and increasing storms. In the last year, I would say that there's been just a cascade of new scientific research demonstrating that not only is it real and dangerous, but that all the numbers are coming in at the high end of what we expected. Temperatures are going up faster. Sea levels are rising faster. Ice is melting faster. Hurricanes are increasing in power faster. All the sort of threats that we've been talking about turn out to be not only true, but really in many ways, I think, underestimated in the public mind. The latest data really is deeply discouraging in a lot of ways and points out just how quickly we need to get down to work.
And you feel that the statements by Tony Blair, the statement by George Bush, the evangelical Christians, all of those sorts of things you mentioned, cascading stories, do you see these statements indicating substantial and real change in perspective, recognizing the seriousness of the problem?
Well, I wouldn't hold my breath waiting for, you know, George Bush to go do anything about any of this. In fact, he didn't even talk about global warming. He talked about dependence on foreign oil, which in many ways is a related but in many ways different topic. I don't think anything in this country is going to happen around global warming until this administration, with its deep ties to the fossil fuel industry, is gone. On the other hand, there are people in Europe who are beginning to do interesting and important things, and there are people in individual American states who are beginning to do interesting and important things. And so I'm not, I think it's a, we're in a tough, very tough place, but if you're looking for some signs of hope, there's some of those out there too, at least in the beginnings of our response.
Jerry Kay is my name, the name of the program, Beyond Organic. Our guest, Bill McKibben, we're talking about global warming. One of the things that you are able to do and have done for many, many years is talk to scientists and learn from them what they're learning about things such as global warming. Anything that really, in your recent conversations, that sticks out in your mind that even gave you, after all these years of looking at the problem, wow, this is unbelievable. What are you hearing from scientists?
Well, I think that the most, there have been a number of stories in the last couple of years, but there was a study in the fall from Britain on soil. Scientists had dug a series of 6,000 holes in 1978, and they went back 25 years later to the same holes to dig up the soil and see what was changing. As the climate was warming, as those forests were becoming, you know, more tropical with longer growing seasons, the soil was more microbially active more of the year, and as a result, more carbon was being released into the atmosphere. A lot more carbon, enough more carbon, just because of the warming that we've already accomplished, that all the things that Britain has done since 1990, and they've done probably more than any other country to reduce their greenhouse gas emissions, all those things have been negated simply by the extra amount of carbon escaping from their soil. We're beginning to see feedback loops operating on a scale that's quite daunting.
How is this impacting you personally? I know you've written and shared a lot of your personal experiences and thoughts about all this. What's it doing to you personally? Just curious.
Well, I mean, I live in the north. My favorite season of all is the winter, and winters are deeply undependable now here. And that's, for me, maybe the single greatest effect. We're seeing, even in these, you know, favored and temperate regions, really dramatic effects. Winters far shorter than they were before. The forests beginning to show real stress, things like that. It's not anywhere near as bad as it's going to be for people having to deal with this in, you know, conditions of poverty, but it's bad enough.
What are you expecting to see in the near future that will keep reinforcing how dramatic, how serious, how this problem will play out? What do you think we might see in the near future?
Well, it's very difficult, of course, to predict precisely what these manifestations will be, but I would be unsurprised if we continued to see wicked storminess across the Atlantic. Last year saw far more hurricanes and tropical storms than we've ever had before. I think it's a reasonable bet that we'll see continued dramatic melts of ice. Every glacial system in the world is now in rapid retreat. And I think what's scarier is the things that we don't expect, the kind of surprises that may be waiting out there. The world turns out not to operate in as linear a fashion as we once imagined. And there are threshold problems, too, things where if you reach a certain point, then things change very quickly. One of the ones that people know about is the possibility that we may be causing a slowdown or shutdown of the Gulf Stream. There may be other surprises like that out there waiting to bite us in the butt.
Do you think the average person in this country is waking up to this problem?
I do. I think that, that all the polling shows that Americans understand that this is a problem and that they'd be willing to do something about it, including spend some money. I don't think that people really understand the magnitude of the problem. Partly because we haven't done a very, you know, our media has been flummoxed in many ways by this story. I mean, it's a very difficult one for them to figure out how to report. So I think people are perhaps not aware of the entire magnitude of what we're facing. But I think that they're beginning to understand it better all the time. Katrina put a human face on a lot of this and made it a lot less theoretical.
You mentioned the media. One of the things, and we've talked about it on this program before, the media is pretty good at event-oriented coverage. They are horrible at process-oriented coverage. And global warming is a process. It isn't a single event.
It's right. It happens quite slowly. And, you know, it's also been very difficult because there's been a very, very strong and concentrated campaign by people with vested interest to keep this story away from the news, to demand spurious balance in all the reporting about it, all those sort of things.
Talking with Bill McKibben, and we, Bill, you're going to stay with us. The name of the program is Beyond Organic. A lot more to talk about with Bill. Bill is, of course, an author and environmentalist, an award-winning author. And a little later on, we're going to bring in somebody talking about what local municipalities are doing. There's a tremendous amount of effort in states now to address issues such as global warming. If you've got you want to check us out on the web, please do so at beyondorganic.com. Also, listen to us on Sirius Satellite Radio. It's the Lime Channel, Healthy Living with a Twist, Lime Channel 114. I'm Jerry Kay. This is Beyond Organic.
Now, more of Beyond Organic with Jerry Kay on Icicle.
Beyond Organic is a production of Icicle Networks and Strauss Communications. Strauss Communications is a San Francisco-based public relations and marketing firm supporting organic products, sustainable agriculture, and critical environmental issues of our times. Find out more online at www.beyondorganic.com or call 415-777-1170.
And I'm Jerry Kay. We're talking about global warming. My guest, Bill McKibben. And Bill, let me ask you something about the question I posed just before the break there about local communities. Is one of the trends you're seeing the efforts by counties, cities, and states to address global warming?
Yeah, absolutely. And this is, to the extent that there's any good news going on in our country, that's where it's coming from. There have been some quite dramatic attempts in recent years. California, under the leadership first of Gray Davis and then of Arnold Schwarzenegger, has done its best to try and sort of backdoor regulate the gas mileage of automobiles since Washington's refused to do it. Their attempts to do that are currently tied up in the courts. They're being sued by the Bush administration. But if they prevail, it'll be a real force for change. Seven states in the Northeast and Mid-Atlantic just joined a kind of regional Kyoto light kind of pact in an effort to control power plant emissions. There are individual cities that are doing interesting things, not just the kind of usual suspects like Portland or Seattle or something, but also places like Salt Lake City. There are some things starting to happen. They're not enough yet to make a real impression on the amounts of CO2 that the U.S. is pouring into the atmosphere, but it's at least the beginning of something that wasn't there not very long ago.
This country has had a couple of examples, maybe a number of examples, where the country did pull together. I think back on World War II as an example, where there was a concerted effort with an objective, and everybody pretty much was unified in that objective. It seems to me that the planet, all the people who live on the planet, all the countries, are going to have something like that, and it's going to have to start largely with this country. Do you have any sense that that kind of a sustained major commitment focused on addressing global warming could happen in this country?
I don't think we're. I think if the world is counting on us, we're in trouble. I think we're the last country to this party. The rest of the world has at least begun to step up with programs like the Kyoto Accords, which are, you know, beginnings, small beginnings, but important in their own way. We've refused to play, of course, in any of that. And, it's hard to see us, I'm afraid, taking a leadership role after being the country that introduced the world to environmentalism. We're now the caboose.
Let me ask you something. We were just talking about the cities and states and what they're doing. What about the federal government? What would you like to see in terms of legislation changes, et cetera? Do you have a list of a couple of things you think would be starting
point? Well, I think that the most efficient and powerful way to begin exacting real change would be a stiff tax on carbon, a tax that would be rebated in other taxes, so it wouldn't amount to a tax increase, but so that you would pay through the nose for using coal and gas and oil, and that this would begin to produce very dramatically the incentives to change behavior and to change technology. The people who would suffer from that, the coal and gas and oil interests, unfortunately own large segments of Capitol Hill, and so they've been able to block that kind of common sense approach. But I think that probably more than anything else, that's what the federal government could do that's extremely difficult for individual states and localities to do that would make an enormous difference.
What about alternative energy? Where do you see a ranking there in terms of near-term and then maybe mid-term, long-term options? What would you like to say?
I think that the first thing to say is, before we even start worrying about renewable sources, what we need to start doing is worrying about conservation. We waste an enormous amount of energy, and it'd be cheap to avert that waste. We could cut our energy use 20, 25, 30, 35% relatively quickly and at a profit. And once we'd done that, once we'd begun to get those numbers heading in that direction, then supplying from alternative sources some of that power wouldn't be quite as daunting a task as it seems at the moment. Clearly, wind is a maturing technology and one that we need to employ, both on large utility scales, but probably even, at least as importantly, on smaller community and local scales. Solar is not yet as cost competitive, but it's heading that way, and of course, government policy could help make it more so. The Germans and the Japanese now are the two leading countries in the world in terms of solar panel installation and photovoltaics on rooftops. That's not because either Germany or Japan is particularly sunny. It's because they have governments that are serious about dealing with these problems.
I hear from solar installers here in California, where we broadcast from, it's even tough to get solar panels in some cases because of the number of panels being installed elsewhere.
That's right. And of course, they're getting all the jobs that come with those. Japan is now the leading producer of solar panels. No big surprise. We seem devoted to living on yesterday's technologies and yesterday's fuels, and in the process, we're creating tomorrow's climate, and doing it in a particularly disastrous way.
I can't believe you wrote "The End of Nature" 17 years ago. Can you? It's unbelievable.
It was a long time ago,
man.
And I got to be honest with you. I would not have thought that we would have made as little progress as we've made in those years. I'm certainly a good person to turn to find out what doesn't work, because I've tried an enormous number of ways to produce more progress on these issues, and with radically small levels of success.
I wonder why your recent book, it's Wandering Home, isn't it, the most recent one?
Yep.
And kind of a different, more focused on human beings and behavior. What have you found? If you look back over the 17 years, it used to be people would say fear produces a response. But in most cases, fear doesn't produce a long-term response. You can talk about smoking as what are the campaigns that work and don't work. What have you learned?
Well, one of the things that interests me more and more all the time is the idea that we will solve this problem right at the point when we solve the sort of deeper problem of hyper-individualism that marks our culture. The reason that the Europeans use half as much energy as we do is not because they have better technology. It's because they have better communities, ones that don't sprawl out forever into suburbs, ones that have cities that are attractive enough that you don't need a 4,000-square-foot house. If we're able to grapple with some of those issues, then perhaps we'll be able to get a handle on these changes in behavior that we really need to make. I'm at work on a book now, the working title of which, anyway, is Deep Economy, and it's very much about this particular suite of issues.
Boy, I agree with you so much. There's an article in the paper about people commuting from San Francisco or to San Francisco and moving farther out to get that 4,000-square-foot home. And there's one story about a couple with a couple of kids, and they moved about 2.5 hours away, and the husband was commuting 2.5 hours every way. And then he decided, well, I'll get a little apartment down there. They ended up getting divorced. And it's like, what were they thinking here? Were they one of the comments in the paper was, well, we weren't together enough and I had to take care of the kids all the time and, you know, all that sort of thing. Well, could you have possibly envisioned what a 5-hour commute daily might have done to this man and to this woman and to these kids? And they ended up getting divorced. I was always taught that when you have choices, you choose one that gives you a sense of freedom. And when you think about that, maybe a 900 square foot home, they could have spent more time together, been part of the community. They would have been freer. And so I think you're right about focusing on community and individuals.
Those kind of changes are very hard to make in a society that's as focused as ours is on, you know, consumption and materialism. It takes real effort to sort of break out of that. And I don't know whether we'll do it in time. I hope so. I'm afraid that the other option, as we begin to deal with the real damage that's coming from, say, global warming, is that we will become even more individualistic and just sort of hole up on our own, you know, and try to tough it out as individuals, as a country, as everything else, when what we need is real effort in communities of all kinds, including the international community.
Bill McKibben, my guest. Bill, please stay with us. You're one of my favorite people on this planet to interview, to talk to chat with. And our producer, Nathan Beers, wants to, when we come back, talk to Bill McKibben about technology and online communities and just the impact that technology is having on our lives. And is it going to produce any positive consequences or opportunities for us to deal with things such as global warming? I'm Jerry Cave. The name of this program, Beyond Organic. I am thrilled you're with us, and please stay with us.
Now, more of Beyond Organic with Jerry Kay on Icicle.
This edition of the Beyond Organic Show is brought to you by Edible Communities. Edible Communities creates community-based local foods publications in distinct culinary regions throughout the United States, Canada, and Europe. Through print magazines, supporting websites, and events, Edible Communities connects consumers with family farmers, growers, chefs, and food artisans of all kinds. For more information, visit ediblecommunities.com. And I'm Jerry Kay, Beyond Organic, the name of the program. Our guest, Bill McKibben. We're talking about global warming. Bill, of course, is a gifted and award-winning author. And we've got some links to information about Bill on our website, beyondorganic.com. And people ask, how can you listen to Beyond Organic? Well, there are radio stations. You can also take us along with you with podcasting. And we're also on Sirius Satellite Radio. We're very appreciative of the Lime channel. Channel 114. And Bill, just before the break, we were talking, or I was raising the question about technology. Where do you think technology, what role does technology play in the kinds of issues we're talking about? Global warming being the issue, and then a sense of community and its impact on people.
You mean technology like the net?
Yes.
Well, I think that it raises real possibilities for building new kinds of communities. I hope that it can be used to help build face-to-face communities, to help people in local areas spend more time with each other and working together on things. I think that that's remarkably important, and I think that there are some examples of that. It's a remarkable technology that at the moment is being used too much of the time for distraction, but that holds real possibilities. I think it's very encouraging that we're spending a little less time with television than we used to, and a little more time at least with the screen where there's some possibility of using it to communicate with other people.
I'm curious a thing about your personal life, and you can answer this or reject the question entirely, but I'm always interested in people who live consistent lives. There are people who go out and speak on topics, and they're driving a big car, and they're flying around the country, and they're talking about appropriate use of technology and our impact on the environment. There are people who talk about We need to connect with people in a sense of community, but they don't do it themselves ever. We hear about people who talk about family and their families are in disarray. Just have you been able to manage this journey that you've been on for at least 20 years and probably longer, talking about these issues, these really important issues, doing it extraordinarily well, being a wonderful a spokesperson and writer? But what about your personal life? Have you been able to manage and balance the two things?
Well, I do better in some realms than in others. You know, in terms of things like energy efficiency, the house we've built here was voted the most energy efficient house in Vermont the year that it was built. I was the first person in Vermont to get to use to buy a hybrid car and get to use it, a hybrid Honda Civic, you know, on and on like that. Probably the more important things we've done in our life in these ways are to only have one child. Happily, we have a remarkably wonderful one. To get rid of the television in our lives many years ago and sort of be removed from that constant source of desire for more and different stuff. And more to be able to explore doing things locally, close to home. I wrote a long piece that was in, of all places, Gourmet magazine this summer about spending last winter eating every single thing that we ate from our valley here in Vermont, seeing what that was like to try to live really close to home, and it was a great deal of fun. It was the answer and quite delicious, too.
Hmm.
On the other hand, I spend too much of my time traveling in order to try to spread this message. I go off and give talks all over the place, and I never know whether if I go to fly across the country and talk to an auditorium of 2,000 people or whatever, my hope is that that they will decide over the next week to do something to save enough carbon to make up for the carbon I spewed into the atmosphere getting out there to talk to them. But I don't know. And there are times when I think I'd be better off just to stay at home and shut up.
Well, if you ever want to do that, you can always call us. At least you're talking to a couple of folks here. Now, you've written a lot about, you mentioned Gourmet magazine, but the interconnections of food, environment, and community. Do you see a focus, perhaps, on community and community food growing being a partial solution to some of the issues, such as global warming?
Oh, it helps a lot. I mean, you know, if I'm depending on, say, lettuce from you there in California out here on the East Coast, it takes about 97 calories of fossil energy to grow and bring 1 calorie of iceberg lettuce back to this side of the continent. That's not a very good, not a very good ratio at all. And so, it's a big and useful change to do those kind of things. Does it solve the problem all on its own? No, nothing does. The point is that we have, no silver bullets. We have dozens and dozens of different things that we need to do, all of them simultaneously, in order to have some chance at dealing with this problem.
What's interesting to me is you can go to a grocery store, for example, and look at a product in a carton or jar or whatever, and you can be reading all the ingredients and the health aspects of it. Or you can simply say, you know, what we're going to try to do is try to buy organic food. We're going to try to buy in season, and we're going to try to buy food locally.
Mm-hmm.
Forget all the labels, and then just eat it and prepare it in moderation.
Mm-hmm.
Done. End of day, we're done.
Mm-hmm.
People talked about xeriscaping. How do we plant? We've got water problems in various parts of the country, certainly in California, so we're going to plant plants that don't require a lot of water. Problem is you're taking plants from Africa, for example, and planting them here in California. What about the insects? What about the soil? What about the microbes that co-evolve with local native landscape, native plants? So just plant native plants.
Mm-hmm.
Simple. Done. We're finished. Mm-hmm. So in some ways, we muck stuff up by making it incredibly difficult.
Mm-hmm. I think that's correct. And I think that we end up spending an immense amount of time and effort, too, doing that kind of thing, when we might well be better off I'm just concentrating on the basics. We're very much a consumer society right now, and those habits are hard to break. The idea that the answer to everything is always to somehow spend some more money on it is hard to break. I don't know whether we'll be successful in doing it or not, but it's probably the most important question that we face.
Yeah, it's also interesting to me that who do you talk to, for example? Do you have like community clubs, meetings, groups that a town council? How do you participate locally? School boards, PTAs?
Oh yeah, no, Vermont's a very participatory place. We have town meeting form of government. You know, that's how we make all our decisions. And we have many other things that are going on. You know, we've got a sort of post-carbon planning group in our county trying to figure out all kinds of things about food and energy supply. There's all kinds of interesting stuff going on here in those terms.
Give us a picture of where you live. Where are you sitting right now? Are you home right now?
Oh, yes.
What's it look like?
Well, there's a tiny, tiny bit of snow out the window, but not much. This big storm that swept the east came south of us. We really haven't had a snowstorm all year. I live on the edge of the woods. I live about a quarter of a mile through the woods from the cabin where Robert Frost did his writing for many, many summers.
Wow.
Which is still there. And I live on the edge of the Breadloaf Wilderness of the Green Mountain National Forest.
The cabin where he wrote his books, is that it's still there, but is it open to the public as a museum, or is it just somebody living in it?
By Middlebury College, and people, writers, whatever, who want to use it can go get the key and go up there and be inspired.
Wow. Have you done that?
I've never actually sat in there and written anything, but I've paused on the porch many times in the middle of a cross-country ski or a long run or something.
Last thought. What do you want to leave us with?
Well, I guess I think that we're well past the point now, Jerry, where we're going to solve global warming or stop it. What we're dealing with now is keeping it from being any worse than it has to be, keeping it merely miserable instead of catastrophic. And that takes an enormous amount of maturity in order to even begin to approach that kind of problem. I'm hopeful that we're beginning to summon that. But it's going to happen sooner rather than later if there's really any point at all in doing it, because the changes that we've unleashed are happening way, way faster, really, than we even understood a few years ago.
Bill, thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
It is a pleasure to talk with you. Really
as always.
Bill McKibben, my guest. The name of the program, Beyond Organic. Now, when we come back, we're going to hear about global warming solutions. One organization is recommending on the local level. So that's you, what you can do on the local level. I'm Jerry Kay. This is Beyond Organic.
Now, more of Beyond Organic with Jerry Kay on Icicle.
Beyond Organic is a production of Icicle Networks and Strauss Communications. Strauss Communications is a San Francisco-based public relations and marketing firm specializing in organic products, sustainable agriculture, and environmental issues. Information is available at www.beyondorganic.com or at 415-777-1170.
And today we're talking about global warming, and I just wanted to thank... I feel like what we do here is really important. And we've done, if you go to our website, beyondorganic.com, and begin to look at the scope of the programs and the topics we cover, it is extraordinary. And you're not going to find the kinds of topics we cover anywhere else. And I wanted to thank, personally, the radio stations that air our program. I wanted to thank Sirius Satellite Radio, the Lime Channel. That's the one we're on. And also our webmaster, John Bendiner, for putting together a great website at beyondorganic.com. So you can get information about all the places you can listen to us. You can download our podcasts. We have two versions, the full program, hour-long program, and also short podcast insights. So thank all of you very, very much. Well, as I mentioned, we've been talking about global warming. Let me bring in from Minnesota, John Bailey. And John is with the Institute for Local Self-Reliance. John, thanks for being on Beyond Organic.
Well, thanks for having me.
Tell us about the organization first. What's the focus? What do you do?
The Institute for Local Self-Reliance was founded in Washington, D.C. in about 1974, and our work kind of flows organically based on the world around us, but always having a backdrop of environmentally sound economic development and designing rules and as if community matters. And we're a nonprofit, and our D.C. office has two fairly large programs right now. One's the Healthy Building Network, and the other is the Waste to Wealth program. And the staff on those programs work with communities around the country, providing technical assistance on a range of issues like green building materials, recycling, scrap-based manufacturing, building deconstruction rather than demolition, and materials reuse.
I love, let me go back to one thing, and I want to talk to you about neutral bonding, climate neutral bonding, I think is what the program is called. But you said demolition versus deconstruction. What's the difference?
Well, the building deconstruction program at the DC office is basically a program that it's targeted at public housing, typically, or public redevelopment projects. And instead of like demolishing a building and landfilling all that material, the Institute helps to train local people to come in and deconstruct the buildings, set up businesses like reuse centers, and sell those materials rather than landfill them.
What a great concept, just to think about that, demolition versus deconstruction. What is something that I think you're advocating called climate neutral bonding? What is that?
Right. In Minnesota, we work more on public policy issues rather than technical assistance directly. And energy, agriculture, municipal telecommunications, and protecting locally owned businesses are our focuses right now. And in the energy sector, I just published a paper, Climate Neutral Bonding, Building Global Warming Solutions at the State and Local Level. And climate neutral bonding is, the policy itself is pretty straightforward. It just requires that any publicly funded building project using municipal bonds is built so it generates no net increases in greenhouse gases from the operation of that building. And the greenhouse gases we're talking about come from the combustion of the fossil fuels used to supply the energy use in the building, the electricity, the heating and cooling and hot water. And so the policy requires that all these emissions associated with the energy use is offset, and that usually requires a little extra cash up front to pay for these offsets. But in general, when you do this, you will still see significant taxpayer savings from the reduced energy use and operational costs of the building.
I was talking to somebody a couple of days ago who was saying that businesses usually look for a 2-year return, so they're not likely to be as supportive unless there's some incentives or encouragement. But governments can look at a longer time frame to see results. Post offices around the country are being built or retrofitted with energy efficient equipment, and maybe it's a 7-year payback. There's definitely a payback, and it's a little longer threshold. Have these bonds been actually executed, and are there buildings that have been built as a result?
I tell you, I have been looking around at this, and I have yet to find a proposal out there or a policy out there in the world that does exactly what we are advocating. So, and if your listeners are aware of something, I'd love to hear about it, actually.
So this is a theory, an idea, but it hasn't really been implemented yet anywhere.
It is. Since this idea we've been kicking around for several years, and it kind of came to the top of our pile last year because of the Seattle mayor's initiative to enlist communities around the country to sign on to the U.S. Mayor's Climate Protection Agreement. And that agreement commits cities to meet or exceed the goals of the Kyoto Protocol. So it's adopting the Kyoto Protocol on the local level. And as of yesterday, when I checked, on Seattle's website, 202 communities have signed on to that initiative so far. And so last year I expected to find many innovative policies, and since one of the centerpieces of our new rules project is our website, where we have hundreds of innovative public policies for communities to download and use in their own cities, I started calling around to see, you know, what was happening, and the responses were all over the map. You can expect that cities like Portland, Berkeley, Seattle, and the Aspens, and Cambridge, Massachusetts of the world have detailed inventories of their emissions. They have action plans. They're implementing plans. And on the other end of the spectrum were cities like La Crosse, Wisconsin, who replied to my questions with, "We signed on to what?" And it turned out that it was a previous mayor that had signed on the city to the mayor's agreement, and the new mayor had no idea that the city had made such a commitment. Hmm. In any case, the survey indicated that many of these communities, needed something that they could enact immediately, and we thought that the climate-neutral bonding would be a good first step for them. And the potential impact is pretty big in terms of the public sector. As you noted, the payback periods can be much longer than in the private sector typically. And in 2004, you see a pretty typical year. There were $230 billion in municipal bonds issued for about 9,000 projects. Hmm. So you see that, you know, you can start impacting things pretty quickly.
John Bailey, my guest. John is with the Institute for Local Self-Reliance. We have a link to his organization on our website, beyondorganic.com. Give us, if you could, John, a little bit of a sense as to what's going on, either in cities, in municipalities, and states around the country. You mentioned the signing on the mayors with the Kyoto Protocol locally. What other things are you seeing occur locally?
Well, there's been some interesting, you know, Bill McKibben touched on a few things, but you see, actually, you can look at a private sector example as a recent development. The Whole Foods Market grocery chain, which I'm sure your listeners are aware of, purchased enough renewable electricity recently to supply 100% of all their electric needs. And so that's kind of a climate-neutral type of project, at least for their electricity use. They're offsetting all their greenhouse gases associated with electricity. And Seattle's municipally-owned electric utility announced late last year that they had gone 100% renewable. And another interesting example of late has been Pacific Gas and Electric out in your neighborhood has just announced a program to the California Public Utilities Commission, which would allow all of their customers to get the climate neutral in terms of their electricity and natural gas use by paying a small, I think it ends up being for a typical residential customer, it would be $50 a year or something like that. And that money goes into a fund to do tree planting in California. And
that's great. So there's, of course, you're going to be letting us know as this whole thing moves forward. I would very much like to get you back on and really continue to report on some of these examples. Mm-hmm. Maybe we should be bringing some of the people in specifically, whether it's PG&E or Seattle or whatever, Whole Foods, talking about them too. And you're welcome to at home to let us know what your community is doing. John Bailey, thank you so much.
Thank you.
We appreciate it. John Bailey with the Institute for Local Self-Reliance. I want to thank our producer, Nathan Beers, our engineer, Jada White, executive producer, Michael Strauss, webmaster, John Bendiner. I thanked you twice today, John. And I want to thank all the stations and Lime Network for broadcasting our program. Thank you very much for listening. I'll see you next week right here on Beyond Organic.